This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you for the next hour till 2 p.m. with two very different, but I think both fantastically interesting guests. The first one is, I'm sure, the more troubling one in some ways. It's Naomi Klein, the well-known journalist who's best known for her earlier book, No Logo. Her new book, which has just come out, is The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And it relates in nearly 500 pages, one example after another, of using natural disasters or economic disasters to completely rewrite the rules of economics for countries that don't otherwise have a choice. It's probably the book that has most excited me, however grisly it may be, in the last 3 or 4 years, and the most exciting book on politics, one that pulls everything together in a way that I sort of suspected but didn't quite have all of the strings in my fingers, but Naomi Klein very definitely does. The last book that impressed me this much was George Lakoff's Moral Politics about 3 years ago. Welcome to Booktown, Naomi Klein.
Thank you. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
I will just admit I'm quite blown away by it. I was actually a little hesitant at the very beginning when you drew connections between literal shock treatment of the electromagnetic variety as it was especially developed by American and Canadian researchers, essentially in the pay of the CIA in the 50s, and then how closely that correlates to the shock tactics that have been used to force extreme neoliberal capitalism on really unwilling countries. But the more I read, the more convinced I was. My listeners don't have the time to read the whole thing now, although I hope they will in the future. Could you tell us a little bit about the connection you see between the two?
Absolutely. And one thing your listeners can do is they can watch a short film that I made with the wonderful director Alfonso Cuarón, who directed Children of Men and Y Tu Mamá También. And we made a seven-minute film that is really focused on the parallels between the CIA interrogation methods and what I'm calling disaster capitalism or the shock doctrine. And that can be downloaded for free from YouTube, or we link to it from the website, my website, naomiklein.org, or theshockdoctrine.com. This is certainly the part of the book that people have the most trouble dealing with, which is, I got interested in literal shock treatment because this was the metaphor that was chosen by the economists who were advancing this radical form of capitalism that we've been hearing for many years about economic shock therapy, whether in former Eastern Europe and then in Iraq, when Paul Bremer rode in with the city still on fire and pushed through what Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, described as the most radical dose of economic shock therapy ever attempted, this sort of extreme country makeover of changing all the laws all at once. I think that the language that we use tells us something about the people that use it, and so it made me want to understand literal shock therapy more, because this was the metaphor of choice. And I just stress that people are uncomfortable with the metaphor, so I'm just kind of reminding them that I didn't choose this metaphor. The Bush administration called the invasion of Iraq shock and awe, and then proceeded with a radical course of economic shock therapy, and then when people resisted their attempts to remake the country into a wide-open free market, then their literal shocks did emerge in the prisons under U.S. control. So I look at torture in two ways. One, as an enforcement tool used when these economic shock therapy programs encounter a great deal of resistance. And I look at, of course, the bloody history of these policies in Latin America, particularly in Chile and Argentina, which were both laboratories for the Chicago Boys, the economists, Latin American economists who studied under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, and then went home and worked hand in glove with brutal dictatorships in the 1970s. And these connections were drawn by Latin Americans at the time. You know, I start the book with a quote from Eduardo Galeano, the wonderful Uruguayan historian, who says, you know, how would it be possible to impose these economic shocks without the electric shocks? Because I think at the time the connection between the two was very clear, and I believe that it's there in Iraq as well. And I don't argue that torture is always there as an enforcement tool, but it has been there at some key junctures, and it's so that's one way in which I look at torture. But the other is I argue that there is an analogy between what happens in the interrogation chamber when these tactics that were developed by the CIA in the 1950s, which are these so-called creative interrogation tactics, are used in the interrogation chamber one-on-one between an interrogator and a prisoner, and what happens to whole societies when they are experiencing what I'm calling disaster capitalism. So what I do is I look at these declassified CIA manuals where they talk about the need to put a prisoner into a state of shock by regressing them, which is done by cutting off their sense of where they are in time and space and who they are, these deliberate methods of sensory deprivation and disorientation and confusion. And then they say that in that window of opportunity, they start to see their interrogators as a father figure and are unable to protect their interests. So I'm arguing that this description of what happens in the interrogation chamber is actually a very good description of what happens to whole societies when, in the aftermath of a huge disaster, and I'm not arguing that the disaster itself is planned, because I'm including natural disasters like the tsunami in Asia or Hurricane Katrina, which of course wasn't only a natural disaster, it was also a government failure that created the disaster. But I'm not arguing that it's a conspiracy. What I'm arguing is that there's such a profound understanding that crises open up windows of opportunities when unpopular policies can be pushed through, that there is a move immediately after a crisis to take advantage of that window of opportunity to deepen regression and disorientation, to play on this mass regression that takes place when we're frightened and we put too much faith in our leaders and look to them as father figures. So I'm saying that torture is both a tool of enforcement for this economic policy, or has been historically and continues to be in Iraq, as well as a kind of a metaphor for what happens when whole societies are remade in their moment of deepest trauma.
And you mentioned that the corollary to the physical torture are the doctrines, the extreme laissez-faire capitalist doctrines of Milton Friedman, which seemed to be in abeyance in the 1950s and 60s, losing influence. But Friedman insisted that his followers should just lie low, get ready, and at a certain point there would be a crisis where they could apply them. And the first crisis was when Augusto Pinochet overthrew the government of Salvador Allende in Chile.
That's right. And you know, I think that many of your listeners sort of know that history, know that, you know, there was that the shock of the military coup. There was also the economic shock of hyperinflation, which really was created by a U.S.-led embargo against Chile. Nixon famously said, "Make the economy scream," after Allende was elected. And you know, this is where I think you most clearly see what I'm referring to is triple shock, where you have the shock, the shock to the country, that being the coup, followed immediately by economic shock therapy. And that's this was actually the first time that phrase was used. Actually, Milton Friedman used the phrase shock treatment in a letter to Pinochet, advising him to push through very, very radical economic change all at once. And as we know, the entire regime held on to power through terror, through the rounding up of dissidents and summary executions and systematic use of torture. Yes, that was the first coup, but I think that was the first crisis that was exploited. But Milton Friedman wrote the sentence that you're referring to: only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change, and when the crisis hits, the change depends on the ideas that are lying around. He wrote that in 1982, and that was the year where there was another leap forward for the ideology that he represented. Some interviewer recently referred to him as the Karl Marx of capitalism, which I think is not a bad description. You know, in the official story of the rise of this radical form of capitalism that is often associated with Reagan and Thatcher, the story that's told is that it swept the globe peacefully and democratically because people wanted it, because all the alternatives had been discredited and the Berlin Wall fell and people wanted their, you know, their Big Macs along with their democracy. And you know, it's a very sort of simplistic version of history. So what I've tried to do is look back at the key junctures and put the crises and the shocks that were so instrumental for the advancement of these ideas back in the story. So back to 1982, when Milton Friedman wrote that, Margaret Thatcher was in power in Britain, and she was really struggling. She had not succeeded in pushing through her ideological plans, even though she was being advised by Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek. She tried. She'd started selling off the housing projects, and she had started taking on some of the unions, and it was a disaster for her political career. In 1982, Margaret Thatcher was at 25% in the polls, which meant that she was guaranteed, really, to win to lose the next election. She would be standing for re-election. She would have to be standing for re-election soon, and her party was at 19%. I mean, things in the country was, you know, in great turmoil. And what actually saved Margaret Thatcher's career, and what allowed her to push through the first shock therapy program in the context of a democracy, was a war. The Falklands War began in 1982, and Margaret Thatcher, you know, leapt into Churchillian battle mode and saw her popularity skyrocket from 25% to 59%, and then she very expertly translated her victory abroad to a war at home. She said, "We have fought the enemy without in the Falklands, and now we must fight the enemy within." And the enemy within she was referring to were the coal miners, and she used a tremendous amount of force and surveillance and just overt violence against the striking coal miners and broke that union. And that was really the turning point, and that also that really paved the way for her rapid-fire privatization plan. So that's just one example of what I mean by putting the crises and shocks back in the story. Not to say that the Falklands War is the only factor that allowed Thatcher to push through these policies. They obviously had some appeal. There were other factors at play. But it seems extraordinary to me to tell this history without the Falklands War figuring prominently, because it saved her career.
And in every single case you detail, there is a crisis of some sort or another, either planned intentionally by the government or the forces who wanted to push through these changes, or an accidental one that they were quite ready to take advantage of.
Yeah, and I think in most cases it is accidental. You know, I think in most cases it isn't, you know, some dark plot, people, you know, rubbing their hands together and planning a crisis. I think, you know, the economic model that we have is pretty crisis prone. So the free market keeps us in a steady stream of crises, whether ecological, political, or financial. So it's more a question of being ready with the ideas when that crisis hits.
At first, this was the result of individual advisors, people like Friedman and many of his followers, or people like Jeffrey Sachs in Poland and the Soviet Union. But at a certain point, the International Monetary Fund was ready to apply these policies any place they saw an opening. This seemed to take place after the mid-80s.
Yeah, and I mean, the International Monetary Fund gets called in when a country is in crisis. And the International Monetary Fund exists to lessen those crises and this is a product of the, you know, Bretton Woods meetings after the Second World War, where there was a consensus that the conditions that had led to the rise of fascism in Europe, in Germany, were very much linked to the fact that the international community, after the First World War, had imposed punishing sanctions on Germany that had precipitated an economic collapse, and that those conditions, that shock to that economy, had created the conditions for the rise of fascism. So it was, you know, this was at the time, you know, at the time Keynes warned that if Germany was punished so, the revenge, he said, will not limp, and warned that that it could unleash forces that would make the First World War look tame. And of course he was right. And so I think it was very much an understanding that Keynes had been right in his warnings about what would happen if Germany was punished and allowed to fall into economic disrepair, that after the Second World War and after he was proven so catastrophically right, institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, those two institutions, were formed with the specific mandate of preventing economic crises, of being stabilizing forces in the global economy. The irony is that they were then hijacked in the 70s and certainly in the 80s by ideologues, many of whom studied at the University of Chicago Economics Department, who believed in this radical version of capitalism and were well schooled in the crisis theory that only a crisis, real or perceived, produces change. And so when countries found themselves facing a currency spiral, a debt spiral, a price shock of some kind, the IMF moved in that window of sort of desperation with the structural adjustment program. And so economic crisis became the lever to push through these radical policies in the 80s.
And theoretically, this was to bring freedom and democracy, but whenever there was a actual democratic choice, the people voted against the changes.
Right, and what happened again and again was that there was, first of all, the people voted for the policies before, but voted against the policies often before. I mean, the best case being Poland in 1989, where you had these breakthrough elections, where a Soviet bloc country was experiencing a democratic renewal, a tremendous excitement. And who people were voting for was Solidarity, of course, the party that had been the voice of the workers under communism, and that represented this idea of a genuine democratic socialist third way, not a Tony Blair third way, but a third way between totalitarian state communism, with its central planning and its lack of democracy and heavy bureaucracy, and what Lech Walesa referred to as the evils of capitalism. He doesn't use that language anymore, but what people voted for in 1989 when they voted for Solidarity was a vision of economic transformation that would have put the state factories in the hands of the workers. I mean, it was really a vision of worker cooperative, of economic democracy as well as political democracy. And unfortunately for the Poles, they were in a state of economic crisis. They were forced to inherit the debts of their oppressors, as so many countries were. So they had to inherit the debts of the Communist Party, who had imprisoned the leadership of Solidarity for so many years. And in exchange for a much-needed bailout, or for much-needed aid, they were forced to abandon their vision of an alternative economy and had to accept economic shock therapy. But then, yeah, when the next elections came around, Solidarity was destroyed in the polls. And once again, you start to see, you know, you do start to see very highly nationalist, quasi-fascist forces rise up because it is dangerous to inflict this type of economic crime, so of economic chaos. And you know, one of the things that's really sad about doing this research is how little has been learned from the terrible history of the Second World War and the Holocaust and the volatility and the danger of shocking economies like this.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, talking with Naomi Klein, author most recently of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. We only have about 5 minutes to go. This book is so rich, I could talk to you easily for an hour, but I want to stick to one or two topics, and then I have two questions, so we're going to have to be fairly brief.
Okay.
One of the results of this you talk about is being that governments essentially being dismantled, hollowed out by these structural adjustments. Eventually, in the United States, they came to the point of privatizing everything, including such things as warfare and security, which had traditionally been among the staple functions of government. And now you think that in Iraq and with companies like Blackwater operating there and within the U.S., including in the aftermath of Katrina, we may be creating a permanently crisis, or as you say, disaster capitalism.
Complex, yeah. And obviously it's building on the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned against. Except for it's far more vast, because when he issued that warning, he was talking about the companies that sell weapons and that the big construction companies that rebuild bridges after they've been bombed. But what's happened in the past 25 years is, of course, that military-industrial complex has grown, but at the same time, the ideological campaign to outsource and privatize the very heart of government, which is to provide security and to take some care of citizens, particularly during times of disaster, these functions have been privatized. And you know, I think that this also should be seen in the context of what I'm describing as the shock doctrine, because much of the sort of leap forward in the hollowing out of government took place in the aftermath of the shock of September 11th, where, ironically, the message that we were getting from the Bush administration was, you know, we will protect you, and nothing matters more than security. And there was really an abandonment of the language of this right-wing free market ideology. You heard much less about it. At the same time, there was a huge amount, as we all know, of concentration of power in the hands of the executive branch. And what that meant in practice was that the government was outsourced without any debate, because, of course, the Bush administration had a free hand. They didn't have to debate the decisions to outsource so much of this new homeland security state that they were building so rapidly to this web of private contractors. So we really only find out what happened when there's a scandal. You know, we hear about Abu Ghraib, and we find out that actually there were contractors who were involved in those scandals, who were involved directly in prison interrogation. And so that's the way we learn that something so essential, so core as prisoner interrogation in a war zone has been outsourced to private companies. We learn about it, really, it's this retroactive scandal investigation is how we learn how much was privatized in that moment of shock. And I think, you know, it is extraordinarily dangerous because it reaches so far beyond the military-industrial complex. It really is a privatized, hollowed-out homeland security state.
Now, I know you have to get off in a minute, and so I'll just make this quick statement. About two-thirds of the way through the book, I was absolutely terrified because I was considering the ultimate crisis, which would be the meltdown of the American economy because of our deficits and our huge balance of payments deficit. But in your last 20 pages, you come across suddenly quite optimistic. What's happening?
Well, you know, I do give some examples of countries that have become shock resistant, and one of, you know, the common thread looking at countries where politicians have tried to exploit a shock and they have failed. And I look at Spain after the Madrid bombings, Argentina after the economic collapse, even Lebanon after the war after Israel's bombing last summer. That the common thread is a deeper knowledge of history and an understanding of how this process works, of how people are exploited in their moments of shock, and really a collective decision not to let it happen again. This is what makes me optimistic, and why I actually felt, even though this research was, you know, at times so horrific, that I really believed at every stage that this was a hopeful, empowering project. Because I think when we are weakest is when we're severed from our history, severed from our stories. That's when we're disoriented. That's when we are exploitable. And so anything that connects us with the narrative from our recent past that puts what we are going through in the context of a collective story, anything that helps us learn from the mistakes of the past, and I hope that the book does do a little bit of that, just in this examination of the mechanics of these shock tactics and how it has worked in so many different countries, that we will become more shock resistant, and that yes, if there is an economic meltdown, and I very much hope that there isn't, that it won't simply be left to the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute to have the ideas that are lying around. You know, it's interesting that this movement really modeled itself after the way in which the left responded to the market crash of 1929 and the rise of socialism, populism, and Keynesianism in the aftermath of that crisis. And they were determined that next time there was a crisis, now I'm referring to the Chicago School economists, that they would be the ones with the ideas lying around. But, you know, I do draw hope from the fact that I think that the reason why this movement is so drawn to crisis, why these ideologues are so drawn to crisis, is because their ideas are so unpopular. And I think we should draw strength from that.
And the greatest moment for hope that I saw in the book is that all of a sudden no one wants to borrow money from the IMF or the World Bank anymore.
Yeah, no, there's been some amazing changes in recent years, you know, we hear so little about them, which is part of why we feel disempowered. But there are many success stories, and I do a little rundown at the end of the book. And it's not to, you know, negate and put like a happy face at the end of this journey, but shock really does wear off. Shock is a temporary state. People do get oriented. They metabolize their past. They tell themselves new stories, and they learn from their mistakes.
Thanks so much,
so
Naomi.
Should we.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, I think we're done because we're 3 minutes past our deadline. But thank you so much, Naomi Klein. I wish I had a full hour.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That was Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. A really wonderful book. The best political book I think I've read in the last 2 or 3 years. She will be appearing at the First Unitarian Church in San Francisco on the 26th, September 26th, at 7:30 p.m. That's an event that's sponsored by City Lights Books. The First Unitarian Church is at the corner of Franklin and Geary Streets in San Francisco. That's 7:30 p.m. on September 26th. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. I've just been informed that Naomi Klein will be on Democracy Now this evening from 7 to 10 p.m. talking for the whole hour, and I sure wish I'd had a whole hour to talk to her, but you can get more then. There's a number of events coming up in the community in the next week of great interest. Probably the biggest one is the annual Word Slingers Festival, which will be next Sunday, the 23rd, at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley. It's a Literature Lives annual event featuring usually one important writer. This year it'll be Oakley Hall, the man, that's the important writer, and Oakley Hall, the band, that's a group of Brooklyn-based musicians who took their name, who named themselves after him, as simple as that. We'll play a bit of their music in a little bit, but before, I want to play an interview that I conducted with Oakley Hall, the man, about 4 or 5 days ago. We talked for about 20 minutes. After that, we'll listen to some of Oakley Hall, the band, and then I'll bring you up to date on some other events. I first started to read Warlock 6 months ago. I was delighted by the first 20 pages, the journals of Henry Holmes Goodpaster, who's a merchant in the city of Warlock and one of the main chroniclers of what goes on there in 1880 and 1881. But then I got to reading it switched to third person, and there was a description of what was going on in the town, who all the characters were, and I suddenly thought, this is just a cliche Western, whereas what Goodpaster had been writing as an educated outsider, he'd been giving a somewhat ironic gloss to everything that went on. And it took quite a while till I got into it, maybe 50 pages, before I realized that you were throwing in every cliche of the Westerns, but that's because that's the way Western life really was on the frontier, and that you were really playing with it. You were.
I was playing also with Western lit, because you know every Western starts with a guy riding into town,
right?
Because then things are going to change. So I had two guys arriving in town at the same time. I was playing some games with the cliche Western as well as.
And it strikes me that that's what you do with so many of your novels. You take a big dramatic situation, which could be the historical past, especially the Western past, or it could be World War II, or it could be ski racing, or something like that, and you you take mythic situations, larger-than-life situations, and start to manipulate them in your own way.
Well, that's right. When I started writing Westerns, I did a lot of research, and I found that there were what seemed to be three great stories that ought to be told, and one was Tombstone and Wyatt Earp, and one was the Johnson County War, which is a big cattleman versus a little cattleman, and the third was, of course, Billy the Kid and his problems. I forget what war that was called, but it was a war of the same.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things seem to be room for them to put some major characters into to see what they do.
And that was in Warlock. Was any of the, I didn't think of any of the characters there as being necessarily Billy the Kid, or was Billy Gannon?
No, Clint Blaisdell was pretty close to Wyatt Earp.
Right.
And the way I got started in Westerns is I lived next door as a boy to Stuart Lake, who's a biographer of Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, was a big book, making Wyatt Earp into a saint. And at some later date, when I was trying to think of what to write, I met a guy on the beach at Delmar, where we lived, who looked like a cowboy, and we got to talking, and he was indeed Walt Coburn, who was a Western writer, and I mentioned that I had lived next door to Stuart Lake, the biographer of Wyatt Earp, and he said, "That murdering son of a bitch," and that was the first inkling I had that there was another view of Wyatt Earp, other than being a great hero gunman, was fighting off bad cowboys. It turned out the cowboys had their own. I went to Tombstone. Cowboys had their own literature. They had a whole bunch of self-published books about what bad guys. when the Cowboys drove Earth out of Arizona territory.
And the main theme, or I would say, in the book is, can you depend on someone like that? Do you, is it, if you need peace, do you need a strong gunfighter to give you peace, or do you have to create it by yourself? And there are two or three characters. Everybody at the beginning thinks they need Blaisdell, the Wyatt Earp character, but as farther on it goes, the more they realize that they need to do it themselves.
That was, of course, what the book was supposed to be about, is how a Western town brings civilization to itself. And first they try to buy it with a gunman, and then they have to be content with just lousy old law.
Now,
I was very much caught with the fact that the people in that novel are aware that they're mythic. And why is this? That's because at that time, the dime novel had just, the huge new literary presses were churning out dime novels, celebrating these people while they were still alive. They would no longer be just barely finished with an exploit when it would be published in a dime novel or fictionalized. This was the big thing that people like Jesse James and people like that had to live with, which was their own myth that they were participating in as they went around and being aware of it.
Now, you continue that in three of your Western novels. I've only read Warlock, the first one, but were you trying to do similar things in the Badlands or Apaches?
The other Apaches is about the Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid story is very interesting because Billy the Kid changes from generation to generation. Sometimes he's a good guy and sometimes he's a bad guy. Sometimes he's the artist against the Philistines, or the last general of the West against the new commercial West, and things like that. And sometimes he's just dirty little Billy. So it was great fun to play with Billy the Kid, which I did in Apaches. Apache just means enemy, and at a certain point, Billy the Kid becomes the enemy. And then in the Badlands. The Badlands is the big cattleman and little cattleman, and that war that went on in Johnson County in the 1890s. And those seem to be the three big stories. There's one other that I did, which was the exploration of the Grand Canyon. So I had a fictional voyage, which was the next trip after Powell's voyage down the Grand Canyon, and that too is a Western that I. The mythic western that I wrote.
You didn't start out writing mythic westerns, though.
No, I didn't. I was kind of writing realistic novels about the life I saw around me. Then I got, because of meeting this guy on the beach in Del Mar, I got interested in westerns, and I read a lot of them. You know, and they're very well written, and the authors loved landscape, and they loved action. He did all that things very well, but the characters, what have you got for a character? You've got the good guy and the bad guy and the big cattleman and the whore with the heart of gold and this neat little school teacher. You don't have many real characters. And I tried to invest them with bigger-than-life characters.
And, of course, you had to take a lot of space to do that. Warlock is probably three times as long as the average Western.
They are big, long novels, no doubt about it.
Now, I noticed that in more recent times, you've started a series, which I've looked at but not read straight through, of mysteries set in San Francisco in the 1890s featuring Ambrose Bierce, the cynical newspaperman and story writer and devil's dictionaryist. What drew you to that?
Well, I thought he'd be great fun to work with, and indeed he was, because he said so many clever things. He said to the novelist Gertrude Atherton that the covers of her book were too far apart. He had a lot of wonderful things that I tried to use there. The trouble is, no one much in the East has ever heard of Ambrose Bierce. Ambrose Bierce is a Western figure, and these books didn't do very well because no one knew who Ambrose Bierce was. I guess that's it. I'm kind of fond of them. I think they're fun, and he's a good detective, and says a lot of clever things. I was unable to make up as clever things for him to say as he made up to say, so I was always trying to fit a situation so he could get off one of his wonderful snappers, which he did. A lot of.
Yeah, I guess I have to disagree with you, because I first ran into him when I was about 15 as a high school student just outside of Chicago, and a number of my friends really liked his books.
Good.
And then the
dictionary is just wonderfully clever.
Yes. And then I read a story, actually, in the Saturday Evening Post sometime in the late 50s, probably, about speculating on how he had disappeared somewhere in the Mexican desert. And
there are continual speculations about how he disappeared into the desert, and there's a new one which came up because the movie The Old Gringo reminded some people of things that they had seen, and there was a battle on the border between Villa's troops and the Federales, and he was there trying to get an interview with Pancho Villa, but apparently was very sick, and they transferred a lot of the people who had gotten wounded in the battle across the border, and they were buried up behind the school in Marfa, Texas, and I suspect that's where Ambrose Bierce ended up. People did seem to think they'd seen a guy named Ambrosio around, because the movie The Old Gringo reminded them of the battles that had taken place there along the border.
Now, I have the feeling that you were partly writing the Ambrose Bierce books just as a pastime while you were working on something more serious, because your latest novel, which I have to admit I have not read, Love and War in California, seems very much to be, more autobiographical than anything else I've seen.
It's true. It's quite a long. I mean, it covers a lot of span of time. It starts in 1941 and goes up to sort of 1980s or 90s or something like that. It's a long book. Most of it is involved in the first 6 months of World War II, and only people my age will remember that time, where people younger don't. We were losing that war up until the Battle of Midway, and there was a lot of consternation about that. And I wanted to get that in, but it's also over 50 years according to Tolstoy, and it's a historical novel, so I guess it's historical too. It goes back to December 8th, 1941 is when it starts.
Now, I'm guessing that you were working on that all the time you were writing the Bierce novels?
Exactly. I was stuck on it for a long time. I couldn't figure out an ending. Finally, I did. And it's a glorious ending, too. I'm very proud of it. But for a long time, I couldn't. And I worked on that novel for 20 years, trying to get it right. And I'm proud of how I got it right. But you're right. I was playing around with Ambrose Bierce while I was hoping I would get some good ending for Love and War in California.
Well, I'm going to have to read it before Wordslingers.
I don't know. I'm going to read from it at Wordslingers.
Oh, you are? Oh, great.
Yeah.
Now, your life, as in literature, a large part of it has been as one of the West Coast's most prominent novelists. The other, though, has been as a teacher and nurturer of other writers. You've been running the Squaw Valley Community of Writers, what, since the late 60s?
Well, I don't run it anymore. My daughter, Brett Hall Jones, runs it now, and she runs it a lot better than I did. She runs a taut shift, and it's kind of a wonderful thing. We get so many letters from people saying, "You've changed my life." We're very proud of that. And I'm proud of it as a founder, not as the current operator of it.
But you're always there.
We're always here to give parties, and I give advice. My advice used to be taken, now sometimes it's taken.
Now, what led you to found that? Because the idea of a, there are writers' conferences of various sorts, and there are writers' communities, but a place where people live together intimately for just a short period of time seems to have been a new one when you started it.
Well, Bill Fair and I founded it, and we started it rather frivolously at that time, back in, say, 1969. The West Coast writers rarely saw their editors or agents unless they made expensive trips to New York. And I'd been to a writers' conference at Antioch College in Ohio, and I thought we could probably do it better. And anyway, we invented a writers' conference where we would have our friends, editors, and agents from New York come out, and we would have some of them participants to help pay the bills, and we would play tennis and have conferences and do panels and things like that. And we did all that. And it kind of worked. And we were very interested in playing tennis at the time. But little by little, we got serious because people started getting published due to our efforts. And they still are. We're very good at helping people change from being writers to being authors.
And it is a very nuts and bolts conference that there are.
It's pretty nuts and bolts, and we have I think I'm kind of tired of this, but then the Saturday morning I start to go down and see these friends like Jim Houston and Lynn Freed and people like come trooping in, and my heart overflows with affection for these people that we've been running this conference for these 38 years.
And how long has Brett, your daughter, been running it?
About 10 now.
And what changes has she made?
We got some money. A couple of people have given us money because they appreciate us, and that is happily received. And with some of this money, we got smaller. And I know that's un-American, but we were running 11 workshops a year, and we decided we only needed to run 10 because that way we could really handle all the good people who applied. And so we did that, and at the same time, the poets were complaining because they had one too many people at each of their workshops. So the poets took less people, and we had one less workshop, and now we're a tighter ship than we were before. And it's kind of fun. The people like Brett and other people who work for us have little kids, and there are a whole lot of little kids around. And that gives it a kind of a generational aspect that pleases me a good deal.
Now, it's been almost 60 years since you published your first novel, and you said you've been worked on your latest one for 20 years. Is that it, or are you still going?
I've got an idea that I'm working on. But I tell myself I don't have to write any more novels, do I? But, you know, what else does a novelist do? I'll probably start something. I've just got notes so far.
Well, there's one other group, the band Oakley Hall, that took their name from you, and they don't write novels. What does it feel to have a band named after you?
Well, I like it. I feel it's a kind of renown that nobody else has much. Yeah, I'm proud, pleased and proud with my band. They're going to play at this event, and they're good. They're noisy, and they're kind of country and western rock and roll. But I just think they're kind of terrific. Maybe that's because they named themselves after me.
That was Oakley Hall, the man, the distinguished American Californian author, best known for his novel Warlock, which we discussed. But he's written many, many others, Downhill Racer, and his latest is Love and War in California. He'll read from that at Wordslingers this coming Sunday, the 23rd, at 7 p.m. at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley. The topic, or the title for the show, is Oakley Hall, the Man, and Oakley Hall, the Band. And there'll also be a performance by the Brooklyn-based band Oakley Hall, which, as you just heard, took its name from Oakley Hall, the man. We'll hear a cut of theirs at the end of the program. The program is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here just a couple more minutes. I want to remind you of a few things that are going on in addition to Oakley Hall the Man, Oakley Hall the Band. The Nevada County Poetry Series is also going to be at the Center for the Arts. That's this Thursday, the 20th, at 7:30 p.m. at the Off-Center Stage. The readers will be Kirsten Casey, Gary Cook, Judy Lebsky, Ivan Lurie, and Scott Young. That's Thursday the 29th, 7:30 p.m. at the Off-Center Stage. And coming up the day after that, a person who I originally had hoped to come on this program, but it didn't work out because of her scheduling, Wangari Maathai, the Kenyan Nobel Prize winner and the first woman and first African woman, I should say, excuse me, the first African woman and the first environmentalist to win the Nobel Prize, will be at Cal Lectures on the 21st, and it's going to be a double-barreled performance. She's going to be reading from her book or discussing her book, which is her memoir called Unbowed, at 7:30 p.m. at the Westminster Presbyterian Church, 1300 N Street at Sacramento. But that afternoon at 1:30 p.m., there's going to be a community tree planting honoring her, and trees will be planted on the state capitol grounds on the southeast side opposite the Rose Garden. That's free and open to the public, 1:30 p.m. on September the 21st. That's this Friday, and she'll be speaking at 7:30 p.m. at the Westminster Presbyterian Church. And finally, Naomi Klein, whom we talked to at the beginning of the program, will be speaking at the Unitarian Church at the corner of Franklin and Geary on the 26th, which is a Wednesday, in San Francisco. And that's about all we have time for. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. We're going to make way for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party, and instead of the music you usually hear, you're going to hear Oakley Hall, the band. No, that's not Oakley Hall, the band. That is...